Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's revelation by the Boston Globe that Mitt Romney stayed on as head of Bain Capital 3 years longer than he had previously stated, during a time that Romney has claimed he is not responsible for Bain Capital's companies that went bankrupt and laid off workers. Chris Rowland, the Washington bureau chief of the Boston Globe, who along with co-author Callum Borchers wrote the Globe article, "Mitt Romney stayed on at Bain longer than he stated," joins us to discuss this embarrassing new information that plays into Obama's TV campaign, which accuses Romney of outsourcing and laying off workers. Then we'll examine the Texas voter ID law hearing before a three-judge panel in Washington, D.C., where the Justice Department's challenge under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 is likely to lead to an appeal that could soon be before the Supreme Court, where the constitutionality of the centerpiece of the Voting Rights Act will be in jeopardy. Wendy Weiser, who directs the democracy program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law School, joins us to discuss the fate of a law that, as it stands, will disqualify up to 800,000 eligible and likely Democratic voters in Texas. Then finally, with today's tragedy in Nigeria, where over 100 people were burned alive trying to siphon gasoline from an overturned tanker truck, we will look further into the rampant problem of oil theft that, according to Nigeria's finance minister, costs the nation $1 billion or more a month in revenues. Eniyede Okure, the executive director of Africa Faith and Justice Network, joins us to discuss how crime, in addition to corruption, terrorism, and ethnic strife, is stifling Nigeria's future. Joining us now is Chris Rowland, the Washington bureau chief for the Boston Globe, who, along with co-author Callum Borchers, broke the important news today in an article they wrote, "Mitt Romney stayed at Bain 3 years longer than he had stated." Chris Rowland previously served as Metro political editor, a healthcare reporter on the business desk of the Boston Globe, and a local and state political writer at the Providence Journal in Rhode Island. He tweets at Globe Rowland. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chris Rowland.
Good evening.
And you have uncovered the fact that 9 SEC filings submitted by 4 different business entities after 1999 describe Mitt Romney as Bain's boss, and one of them in particular states that he remains the firm's sole stockholder, chairman of the board, chief executive officer, and president. And this was a couple of years after the 1990 date that he has repeatedly stated was the time that he left Bain Capital to head up the Olympics in Salt Lake City. This has created quite a stir, understandably. What's your sense of the position that Romney is in now? Because he surely can't claim that he made false filings to the SEC.
Right. So, you know, a fundamental defense of Mitt Romney during his campaign for president, when faced with attacks from President Obama and other Democrats about the workings of Bain Capital, including things like bankruptcies and layoffs, has been, hey, I wasn't there. You know, I left in 1999 to go run the Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City. So what these documents now show is that that's a much more complicated story than he has let on in the past. These documents show that, in fact, he remained president, CEO, chairman of the company. Even though he was in Salt Lake and running the Olympics, he continued to maintain legal control and authority over the Bain Capital. So I think it undermines to a certain extent his political ability to sort of wriggle out of responsibility or blame for some of these things. And that's why it's caused quite a bit of consternation in his campaign.
But your article reveals even more, I think, Chris Rowland, in as much as during this period the 3 years, 3 extra years that he remained in charge of Bain Capital, he created 5 new investment partnerships.
Right, it's very puzzling. It's difficult to understand and reconcile how these different statements from the campaign can be true. So on one hand, they've said very clearly in financial disclosure forms that, you know, he retired from Bain Capital on February 11th, 1999. But that's these new documents would seem to stretch the definition of retire, beyond credibility, because he's actually, listed for 3 years, and not just in some sort of legacy carryover, as you say, but indeed even in January 2002, creating five new Bain investment partnerships. So it's difficult to reconcile. It's I think most people would look at this and scratch their heads and not quite understand how both these facts can be true at the same time. The campaign and some of his allies have suggested, on background, that they haven't really come out and explained exactly what these SEC documents mean. They haven't addressed the question head on. But what they have suggested is that these are sort of a kind of a legal technicality, that there was some sort of transition period after he departed hastily to go run the Olympics, and therefore, these were sort of automatically filed. But again, they haven't said that on the record, and even then, it doesn't quite make sense because we're talking about a time frame of 3 years.
Well, but in addition to the SEC documents, Chris Rowland, you've uncovered Massachusetts financial disclosure forms filed in 2003 that state that he still owned 100% of Bain Capital in 2002. And also, these forms indicate that he earned at least $100,000 as a Bain executive in 2001 and 2002, separate from his investment earnings. So that's a pay stub, right?
Right. What all these things go to also is that there's sort of two bits of – there's two ways that the Romney camp has two stories they put out. One is in the earlier going at the time, the frame of mind of Mitt Romney was that he was taking a leave of absence. So that's a lot different than retired. He said in a 2002 hearing in Massachusetts when he was running for governor, he was being challenged as to whether he could be on the ballot or not because he had spent perhaps too much time in Utah. He won that challenge, by the way, of course. But during the testimony, he said, "Well, I took a leave of absence, and my frame of mind was that I wasn't sure what I was going to do." I think that what we're seeing here is then, fast forward 15 years, and they're looking back to that point, 1999, and they're being much more definitive about that departure now than even Mitt Romney felt about it at the time, according to his own testimony.
Again, I'm speaking with Chris Rowland, the Washington bureau chief for the Boston Globe, who, along with co-author Callum Borchers, broke important news today in an article they wrote, Mitt Romney stayed on at Bain 3 years longer than he had stated. So this indicates, surely, I think to be fair here, Chris Rowland, that a lot of people have asked for Mitt Romney to also reveal more of his tax filings in accordance with what his father did when he ran for president. So far, he's only released tax returns for 2010 and partials for 2011. Do you think that these surprises that you uncovered in terms of his tenure as the head of Bain Capital, is there likely to be more pressure then for him to release further documents, particularly tax documents?
I think it certainly will increase the pressure. I don't know what the result will be, but I think that one of the problems for Mitt Romney and his campaign is that the source of his extraordinary wealth, north of $250 million, $250 million, is largely Bain Capital. And yet, so much of that private equity firm's dealings are they're opaque. They're not transparent. It's a privately held company, rightfully so, legally so. But for a politician to be then running with that type of business background makes it very difficult because there's so many deals, so many controversies, so many different, interpretations. And then the way that they conduct their business is really secretive. I mean, you don't know exactly who they're raising money from and how they're investing it, and that's part of the business model. So I think that this, and also that's reflected again in the campaign's reluctance and Bain Capital's reluctance to really describe what the heck was going on during these 3 years from 1999 to 2002, where now, there's these clues, it's evidence in the SEC forms that he was indeed, at least legally so, the president and CEO of that company. And yet they won't come out and explain exactly what his relationship was and what he was doing and why those documents were filed. So it's the sort of the lack of explanation, the lack of transparency that I think sort of adds to the overall problem for Mitt Romney on this front.
Well, Chris Rowland, I recently spoke with a colleague of yours who does a business investigation into the genesis of Mitt Romney's biggest or earliest killing when he was at Bain Capital, and that revealed that first big chunk of change that he got was financed by Michael Milken, who at the time was under SEC investigation. Looking further into it, I find that Michael Milken also was a financier behind all of the big super PAC donors to Romney's campaign, Sheldon Adelson and Sands, Harold Simmons, and David Koch, who was on the board of directors of Milken's foundation.
Well, that's very interesting. You know, certainly a lot of these business networks, they're friends and colleagues, and they you know, when there's big pots of money and there's not that many of them, and they tend to all gravitate to the same places. You can look at Bain Capital is one of the biggest private equity companies in the United States. There's, you know, it's right up there in the top 10, top 15, top 20. I don't remember exactly where it's ranked, but and when big corporations need money, that's where they go.
Well, I guess, though, that where Romney is really vulnerable, and apparently TV campaign that Obama has out now, where he's doing these ads saying that Romney's the outsourcer and the job killer, not the job creator, I'm paraphrasing, obviously, and that Obama is the insourcer. I wasn't aware there was such a word, but it's in the commercial. That's apparently being effective in some of the swing states, and some of Romney's poll numbers have come down. I imagine this is not going to help in that regard, isn't it? Because the whole Romney's excuse up until now has been that he was out of Bain in 1999, and therefore he's not responsible for the Bain Capital companies that went bankrupt and laid off workers.
I think it definitely makes it harder for him to refute those charges that he and it makes it harder for him to use the easy answer of, hey, I wasn't there. Because now people will counter and say, well, wait, you were. You know, there's SEC documents that say that you were in charge of that company. He's going to have to come up with a new answer and a new excuse to explain you know, how that works and what those relationships were. I think it's going to be difficult.
Well, your article in Chris Rowland in today's Boston Globe, Mitt Romney stayed at Bain 3 years longer than he stated, indicates that this came up back when he was a candidate for governor in 2002, when Democrat Shannon O'Brien featured a laid off worker from a Kansas City steel mill that went bankrupt in 2001 after Bain Capital had reaped a handsome profit from its investment in the company. That's the GST steel company that has been already in the news, right?
Right. So there you have one where that's been his standard answer has been that I was not involved because I wasn't there. That's a good one because it shows that, you know, now his opponents can bring up GST steel and try to tarnish him with it more directly, and it's going to make it harder for him to refute based on those charges. I think he'll continue to say, hey, I wasn't there. You know, those SEC documents were really a formality, a legality. I suspect that's what he's going to end up saying. So far, he hasn't said it. I don't know, you know, what the legal ramifications of saying that are going to be. You know, that we do have contradictory filings, you know, one set with the SEC, one set with his financial disclosure forms. And they sort of seem to say two different things. One says he retired from Bain Capital on February 11th, 1999. That's in his financial disclosure form that he signed. And these other ones are the SEC documents, which say that he didn't retire and he was president of the company. So it's a complicated quagmire. I don't know how much the voters are going to understand this, but it sort of adds up to, I think, more kind of concern and smoke and head scratching about what the heck, how Bain Capital works, and you know, it's a big, complicated company with a lot of resources that is not a transparent operation, and I think that's what they're living with.
But the SEC filings that you've uncovered indicate that GST Steel, which went bankrupt in February of 2001, that Romney was very much still at the helm of Bain Capital for even a year after that. So, and also in
he was president, right? He was president, and the SEC documents say he was president at the helm. You know, the Romney people deny it. That's the conundrum here, is that the Romney people say he wasn't at the helm, irregardless of what the SEC documents say. So that's, we're really dealing with a situation that of contradictory documents that, in you know, ultimately no one's reconciled them yet, and that's the challenge for the Romney campaign right now.
Well, but these documents are pretty unambiguous, don't they? They say that Romney was the sole stockholder, chairman of the board, chief executive officer, and president of Bain Capital.
They are unambiguous. I agree with you.
So in your article, you've talked to a former SEC commissioner who says that these contradictory statements could have legal implications in some instances.
The legal implications are, that you're supposed to file documents that are accurate with the federal government, you know, under various penalties of false documents and or, depending on what type of document, perjury. His financial disclosure form, he signed, it's a form of oath. I mean, he's promising that these documents are true and accurate. You know, whether or not that leads to a criminal prosecution, I kind of doubt that. You know, I think you have to have intent to deceive, and I'm not sure if, sort of political fudging is intent to deceive. So whether it turns into I suspect it wouldn't turn into a criminal proceeding, although I would not be surprised, and, it's always not so smart for reporters to start speculating what might happen in the future. I would not be shocked, perhaps, if this issue continues to gain steam and people continue to investigate and find out more stuff, if maybe at some point the Romney campaign has to file some amended documentation to explain on his financial disclosure forms. Well, you know what? He didn't actually retire in 1999. He took a leave of absence in 1999. But still, that would be, it would open him up to, as you say, considerable new questions about his culpability in a variety of Bain deals that didn't go so well in terms of layoffs and bankruptcies and financial difficulties for various communities across the country.
And as you suggested, that his best defense would be, I'm a politician. I exaggerate. That's not exactly a good defense, is it?
I wouldn't say so, no. But I do think that the idea of criminal proceedings are, frankly, I think that's far-fetched. I think
so.
The Obama people were talking about felonies and stuff, and I just, I don't know about that.
Well, I'm sure they're having a bit of Schadenfreude, aren't they? They're enjoying him twisting in the wind here.
Oh, yeah, they're feasting on it, absolutely.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Chris Rowland, and thank you for this important revelations that you've brought forth.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Chris Rowland, the Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe, who, along with co-author Cullum Borchers, broke important news today in an article they wrote, Mitt Romney stayed at Bain 3 years longer than he stated. Chris Rowland previously served as Metro political editor, a healthcare reporter on the business desk at the Boston Globe, and a local and state political writer at the Providence Journal in Rhode Island. He tweets at Globe Roland. We're going to take a brief station break here, and we'll be back in a moment talking about the Texas Voter ID Act, which may end up before the Supreme Court in a challenge of the Voting Rights Act itself.
clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Wendy Weiser, who directs the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, where she founded and directed the Center's Voting Rights and Elections Project, which has protected the voting rights of hundreds of thousands of citizens in recent years. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wendy Weiser.
Thank you for having me.
And the trial before a three-judge panel in Washington, D.C., to either uphold or strike down the Texas voter ID law, of course, has become quite politicized, if you will. Just a few days ago, addressing the NAACP in Houston, the Attorney General said, "We will not allow political pretext to disenfranchise American citizens of their most precious rights." And he went on to say, "Under the proposed law, concealed handgun licenses would be acceptable forms of photo ID, but student IDs would not. Many of those without IDs would have to travel great distances to get them, and some would struggle to pay for the documents they'd need to obtain them. We call those poll taxes." So where do we stand now in terms of the trial in Washington, D.C.?
Well, tomorrow is the last day of the hearing. That's before three judges in Washington, D.C., where Texas is trying to persuade the court that its new restrictive voter ID law was not passed with the purpose of discriminating against minorities and does not discriminate against minorities. And unfortunately, that's not what the evidence shows. But that is what's at stake. That's what it's at issue in this case is, you know, can Texas show that this is not discriminatory, that this will not harm Latinos and African Americans more than it harms other citizens?
But my understanding, Wendy Weiser, is that there's more at stake, and that is that under the Civil Rights Voting Rights Act of 1965, Section 5 requires preclearance to a number of states with a history of Jim Crow restrictions, etc. Texas falls under that. Isn't it likely that this case now before these judges could end up in the Supreme Court and Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act could be challenged?
Absolutely. Texas has, in bringing this case, Texas didn't only argue that its law was not discriminatory. It said even if it is, we shouldn't have to defend it in court. This Voting Rights Act should be struck down in its entirety. That's actually not before the court this week. The court is going to first decide whether or not Texas was able to show that its law was not discriminatory before considering that question. But that is definitely part of this case, and it's a part of everything that Texas is putting forward. It Texas claims that it needn't show, it shouldn't have to show that its law is not discriminatory. And that's really unfortunate. Texas is one of a handful of states with a history of discriminating in voting rights. And those states, Congress found overwhelmingly in 2006, should have to show before they try to implement new voting changes that they're not discriminatory. You have a bad record. We don't trust that your laws aren't going to be discriminatory. And until you clean your record up, you have to show that your law is not discriminatory before you change your voting procedures. Texas, again, it's only a handful of states that are covered by this obligation, and Texas is one of them because it earned that.
So what are the steps then? You've got this three-judge panel. There's an expectation that they will strike down the Texas law and then it will be immediately appealed. The three-judge panel includes two Democrats and one Republican appointee. And then there's also another case working its way through the courts, a Shelby County, Alabama lawsuit. So I guess one way or the other, Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act is going to get to the Supreme Court. And when do you think that'll happen?
Yeah, certainly sometime within the next year, we are going to see Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act before the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court upheld the law very narrowly, or just dodged a case challenging the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act a couple of years ago, and it raised some questions that people are now litigating and thought, and we've seen now an unprecedented number of attacks on the Voting Rights Act. Really an about-face for many states because the Voting Rights Act was approved with overwhelming bipartisan majorities back in 2006 and signed into law by being a real sea change in people now pushing back against what is widely acknowledged as the most successful piece of civil rights legislation. You know, it's too early to predict what the judges are going to do in this Texas case. But there is a direct appeal on Voting Rights Act cases to the Supreme Court. The Shelby County, Alabama case, a three-judge court, already said that the Voting Rights Act was a lawful exercise of Congress's authority. It upheld the Voting Rights Act. And that is likely to be, we're likely to see papers filed in the Supreme Court in the next month by those who were challenging the Voting Rights Act. It's hard to tell which case will end up in the Supreme Court first.
Again, I'm speaking with Wendy Weiser, who directs the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, where she founded and directed the center's Voting Rights and Elections Project, which has protected the voting rights of hundreds of thousands of citizens in recent years. So the last time that this issue was revisited, we don't have a vote from the Supreme Court as a precursor or a harbinger of what might happen when it reaches the Supreme Court?
Well, you know, the Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act a few decades ago. I mean, the similar challenges were brought, and the Supreme Court strongly said that this was a constitutional and important exercise of Congress's authority. In fact, Congress had a strong reason to protect the American citizen's fundamental right to vote against what was a strong history of discrimination in a number of states. And the Congress found again in 2006 a similar record of just discriminatory tactic after discriminatory tactic. And so the court considered this case a challenge in 2007, and it avoided the challenge. It did express some doubts as to the constitutionality of the act, but it very strongly avoided striking down what is clearly the most important piece of civil rights legislation. So it's very difficult to predict what a court would do in this case. It would be a really dramatic and act for the court to overturn this kind of cornerstone of our civil rights infrastructure.
Well, that certainly doesn't stop people like myself from being a little skeptical. We've seen the court make some fairly radical rulings with Citizens United, and you know, the healthcare bill only squeaked by, and even in victory, there are some parts of that ruling that trouble some people who think that it could actually lead to some rather radical libertarian overturning of things like Title IX. So, you know, pardon me for being a little bit dubious about this court in terms of its propensity to take small cases and blow them up into radical rulings.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But I certainly hold out hope that the Voting Rights Act is still on secure ground. We've seen, you know, more and more evidence this year that it is just really needed. Over the past 2 years, we've really seen a massive wave of new laws making it harder for eligible American citizens to vote. And these laws have all been targeting especially African Americans and Latinos and other minorities that are protected by the Voting Rights Act. And so there's really and really a disproportionate number of these laws have been passed in the states that have a history of discrimination and are covered by the Voting Rights Act. So it's really strongly needed, and the evidence is only mounting, and that should strengthen the case before the Supreme Court.
So, Wendy Weiser, in terms of the Attorney General Holder's remarks last Tuesday before the NAACP And, of course, he was followed by Mitt Romney, who also spoke there, making no mention of voting rights and of this kind of across-the-board effort on the part of Republican governors around the states to pass these new voter ID laws that your center some time ago did a study indicating that as much as 5 million or as many as 5 million eligible voters could be denied the vote in 2012. He pointed out, Holder pointed out last Tuesday, that 25% of African Americans do not have the type of IDs Texas require to vote, while just 8% of whites do not have a valid ID. And the idea that a concealed handgun permit is okay, but community college student ID is not, certainly raises one's suspicions about the notion that this is all about preventing voter fraud. If it ever gets to the Supreme Court, could you make the argument that Holder is making, that this is a poll tax, because poll taxes were deemed unconstitutional by the 24th Amendment?
Yeah, this is certainly an argument that is available to be made before the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has already made clear in an earlier voter ID case that came before it that states that are trying to impose voter ID requirements have to make the kinds of ID that they're requiring accessible and free to all citizens who want to use them for voting. So, and if they are not, then that would be a poll tax. And there's mounting evidence that not only are states not doing that effectively, but there are also indirect costs that are a huge barrier for many Americans to getting voter ID. So, for example, in most states, you need to have a birth certificate in order to get the free photo ID that the states are supposedly going to offer. But the birth certificates typically cost around $20 or so, and that in itself is more than what the poll tax was back in 1974.
Again, I'm speaking with Wendy Weiser, who directs the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, where she founded and directs the center's Voting Rights and Election Project, which has protected the voting rights of hundreds of thousands of citizens in recent years. Now, yesterday, before this three-judge panel where the Texas voter ID law is being challenged under the Voting Rights Act for pre-clearance, Texas is fighting it, and as we've mentioned, if they lose, they apparently intend to take this to the Supreme Court to challenge the very nature of Section 5 and the Voting Rights Act itself. In testimony yesterday, Henry Flores, a political science professor and dean of the Graduate School of St. Mary's University in San Antonio, he said that there have been 100 pieces of Texas legislation that he suggested there is a legislative bias against the growing population of Hispanic immigrants. And he felt that that was what this was about. This is really not a voter ID law so much as an anti-immigrant bill.
And that is one of the key issues in this case. You know, there is a significant evidence that this law was passed with the intention of discriminating against Latinos and African Americans in Texas. It was a very highly charged environment around the passage of this law, and really unusual procedures used. They declared emergency legislation and bypassed all the usual legislative procedures in order to get these voter ID, this highly restrictive voter ID bill through the process. And what's really at stake here is the right of hundreds of thousands of eligible voters in Texas to participate in the elections. And it's not just minorities, it's hundreds of thousands of people of all races and creeds, and it does disproportionately affect Latinos and African Americans as well. But even according to Texas's own conservative figures, you know, between 605 and 795,000 registered Texas voters don't have state-issued photo IDs that they're requiring. So the stakes are really large.
Well, this is an extraordinary coincidence, Wendy Weiser. I just did an interview a couple of days ago with the leading pollster in the state of Pennsylvania, who was neither a Democrat nor a Republican. So I think he gave a very objective analysis of the new voting restrictions that have been passed in Pennsylvania, which, of course, is a key swing state. The head of the Republican House in the State House in Pennsylvania let the cat out of the bag by speaking at a Republican event where he said that the law they just passed will ensure that Romney wins the state of Pennsylvania. And when they passed the law in Pennsylvania, they said, oh, only a handful of people are going to be affected, those that would be committing fraud. It turns out that the figures of people who are being eligible voters are going to be ineligible because of this new voter ID law in Pennsylvania is almost identical to the Texas one, 800,000.
That's right. And politicians really shouldn't be allowed to manipulate our voting rights for our own benefit. What people don't realize are that these laws that we're seeing in Texas and Pennsylvania are not reasonable ID laws that just ask people to identify themselves by showing ID they do have. They cherry-pick the IDs. They're highly restrictive with a very narrow form of IDs. And unlike laws that we've seen in the past, there's no process for people who don't have those small number of IDs to go through to demonstrate their identity and still vote a ballot that will count. And that is that makes them dramatically different than anything else we've seen beforehand and dramatically more harmful to voters who get caught in the net.
Well, just in closing, Wendy Weiser, we've learned some time back that a lot of these laws, and they've been passed in 11 states, and that many ways that these are predetermined laws drafted by ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which since the shooting of the young man in Florida, a lot of the corporate sponsors have left it because one of the laws that ALEC pushed throughout the states was the Stand Your Ground law. But more importantly, in terms of what we're talking about, they also drafted these model laws that have been enacted in 11 states, these voter ID laws that have appear to be targeting registered Democratic voters. And it makes you wonder how much this will become an election year issue and how much in this country you can make a case about the sanctity of democracy itself. One would think that most Americans, being fair-minded, would feel that this is really beyond the pale, that you know, the reason you have an election is that it is a level playing field and that the person who wins deserves to win, not by fair means, not by foul means.
That's absolutely right. This country was founded on a creed of political equality, that all men are created equal. And it's just wrong to pass laws that will exclude some groups of Americans from the political process and to do so for partisan political gain, not with on a fair playing field. And that's exactly what's going on here. And these are laws that are hiding what they're actually trying to do and what they're actually accomplishing. And it's so in that way, it's doubly harmful because people don't realize, you know, what's going on and what effect this is going to have. And there's good news, though. There's been real successful pushback. The courts have been, so far, we've seen at least two courts in Wisconsin rejecting the photo ID laws that were passed in that state. We have seen the Department of Justice pushing back very strongly against the South Carolina and Texas laws. There's a lawsuit pending in Pennsylvania. So the story's not over. As of today, of those 11 states that you're talking about, only three of them are slated to go into effect in 2012, unless they're blocked by a court. Now, that might change depending on what happens with the Texas trial, for example. But right now, we only see Kansas, Pennsylvania, and Tennessee will have those in effect. So there's been some pushback, and the story's not over yet, but it is clearly an election year issue. It will clearly have an enormous effect on who can vote and how they can vote, and it is clearly a matter of fundamental fairness that we get this right.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Wendy Weiser.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Wendy Weiser, who directs the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, where she founded and directs the center's Voting Rights and Elections Project, which has protected the voting rights of hundreds of thousands of citizens in recent years. We're going to take a brief station break and be back in a moment talking about the prolific theft of gasoline in oil-rich Nigeria.
Some people lost some bread. Someone nearly died. Someone just died. Police, they come. Army, they come. Confusion everywhere. Hey-ya. 7 minutes later, all done cool down, brother. Police don't go away, army don't disappear. Them leave sorrow, tears, and blood.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Eniadi Okure, who is the Executive Director of Africa Faith and Justice Network, a community of advocates for responsible U.S. relations with Africa. Born in Nigeria, he has served in various pastoral capacities in Nigeria, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eniadi Okure.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And Eniadi, this incident that took place today, where a tanker truck overturned and people crowded in on it, trying to siphon off gasoline that was spilling all over the place, and apparently a lot of the people that did it were these little sort of motorized cab drivers, and then the thing exploded, and over 100 people were burned alive. It's obviously a tragedy, and there have been others like it. But it sort of opens a window into a broader problem, doesn't it, not, that is rampant in Nigeria, and that is oil theft.
Yeah, you're right, absolutely right. I would say that, what is happening here, as you say, underlines a much bigger problem. And the problem is that there is this atmosphere in the country of the lack of rule of law. And it is perpetrated by the higher ups that gets a domino effect. So those lower just see what their leaders are doing, and they feel that they themselves could have a share in it. Okay, let's turn to what you've just said about this unfortunate incident. Where a tanker overturned and then leaking fuel, people rushing in to get a share of it. Imagine the mentality that I understand the security forces were there trying to push them back, but they would have none of it. They're rushing to get it. It's like, oh, let me go and get my share. After all, the bigger guys are stealing it. If I can get just a tiny little part of what is actually, quote, my share, then that's okay. So there is that attitude that has perverted the country, and they feel that they are entitled to it because of what is happening at the top. So oil theft in Nigeria, it's been going on for well over 3 decades, but it has become a very serious issue in the last 10, 15 years. You look at the amount of oil produced by the country and the actual revenue that comes from oil. It's about half. So what happens to the rest? Is being stolen, is being diverted, is being illegally transacted. And so the people end up with little or nothing.
Well, I was going to say, the Shell Oil Company, which is the biggest single producer in Nigeria, estimates that 150,000 barrels of crude are stolen in the country every day. And Nigeria's finance minister, Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, has put the loss even higher in June.
About $1 billion a year. Yes.
Stolen, no, $1 billion a month.
$1 billion a month. In fact, more than $1 billion, because when you see the figure she gives, you are looking about $13 to $14 billion a year. Now, in fact, recently it's been discovered that the security forces in the Delta region have closed down about, listen to this, over 1,000 illegal oil refineries, even a petty makeshift oil refineries, within the Delta region in the past 5 months.
Wow. Well, you know, that isn't this a part of the problem, that the government made a peace treaty with MEND, M-E-N-D, the guerrillas that were operating in the Niger Delta?
In the Niger Delta region, right.
And these guys were capturing crews of oil tankers and oil workers, et cetera, and holding them in the jungle. And it looks like the deal that they made with MEND is a deal for the people who made the deal are in collusion with MEND in terms of criminality.
Yes, I mean that has been said. People say that the deal was not really a deal; it was just to end the conflict. But then they found other ways to do it. You look at what has happened, that the waterways has become, even after the so-called deal was made and the conflict was abated, that the waterways became even more, you know, patrolled. Despite the Navy patrolling the waterways, they are coming day after day after day with illegal traders, illegal bunkering that is going on, even in the high seas. And to the extent that it goes way up into the high seas, and people have connived and found ways of shifting it there and then having it stolen where it is beyond the reach of ordinary people. But having said that, I think that to return to what you underlined, that there is it hits at a larger problem. And I want to stay with that a little. There is a real pervasive problem here. You know, so that sometimes the very people who are sent to probe and clean it up end up being entangled with it. In fact, recently there is a report going on of the chair of the commission probing malpractice within the oil sector. And months into the probe, he himself is accused of taking about $500,000 bribe to alter reports and all of that. So you wonder, when you have that kind of involvement, how are we going to clean this up? There's a real lack of accountability in the oil sector. And I dare to say that Nigeria would have been a better country if oil was not discovered. And I say that very strongly. I can give several reasons for that.
Well, there's a term for that, NEADI Akure. The term is a resource curse.
Yeah, that's it. You know, it's a resource curse, because if one looks at the history of Nigeria, the oil sector is the single most corrupting agent in that country. First of all, in terms of what it does for the people, you look at the agricultural sector got depleted because of oil, because of the discovery of oil. Nigeria used to export palm oil and kernel, sorghum, cotton, rice and beans, cocoa, all that were abandoned when oil was discovered. Why? Because the politicians found out that they could easily make a deal with oil and become millionaires overnight. So gradually, the agricultural sector was decimated. Nigeria now imports food, including those it used to export before the discovery of oil. And there are some who argue that if oil had not been discovered, there would not have been a civil war in that country. Again, not to talk of the environmental damage from oil spills, both in the waters and on land. And the creek area with all that ecosystem has been decimated. You know, mangrove swamp that is pervasive in the Delta region, from Warri through Port Harcourt into Calabar, and it's been spoiled almost completely from oil spills. So it becomes each time you look at even state governors who steal money, generally from the oil revenue. So it's really become a curse. And the pervasiveness is so great that one wonders how this is going to be tackled. Politicians and their friends set up bogus companies for oil business. Some of them, they exist, and some are companies that have absolutely nothing to do with oil. For instance, last year, around November last year, an investigation into, quote, what it was dubbed in Nigeria, the oil cartel. You know, it sounds like the Colombian drug cartel, but that's how they dubbed it, oil cartel. An investigation revealed that many companies sharing in the oil business who were getting contracts and money were actually construction companies that had nothing to do with oil. And yet some of them got shares from the oil that they were, quote, importing or exporting, totaling about $10 billion within a period of 5 months.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Eniadi Akure, who is the Executive Director of Africa Faith and Justice Network, a community of advocates for responsible U.S. relations with Africa. He was born in Nigeria and has served in various pastoral capacities in Nigeria, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and the United States. So on top of the enormous corruption in Nigeria, you have the terrorist threat from Boko Haram, you have intercommunal violence, and then you've got this outrage that we're talking about, the theft of the nation's key resource by these indigenous criminal enterprises that are often hybrids of criminals, security people, and politicians. You mentioned the number of illegal oil refineries in the bush. Little wonder there's so much pollution. What I would find extraordinary to figure out, since about half of the oil is stolen that you mentioned earlier, Eniadi, tell me about how you have a network of, it's called bunkering, I believe, in Nigeria, but how do you have a network of a criminal enterprise that takes the stolen oil and gets it to market? How does that operate? Do they have kind of ghost tankers that come in at night and they fill them up?
You know, some of it, yeah. You know, of course, for people to do that, you talk of artisan refineries. Those ones are really the little guys at the end of it. The stealing is real high tech because, there was last year a documentation from Al Jazeera showing how some of these high tech engineers connected with management in the oil sector, they will go into the pipe late in the night into the pipes, and they know how to let out the oil and siphon it out as they come through the oil wells, siphon them out and take it by boat to something else and distribute and sell it to these small guys who go into the small refineries. So it's really a high-tech theft in the first place, which tells us that there are people in high places orchestrating it, because the small guys can't just afford to do what is being done. So it's not a matter of this. It's a question. Let me draw an analogy here. It's like the little guys who run drugs on the street, you know? And you know that there's some big man somewhere controlling the cell. That's what is happening here. In fact, that's why some Nigerians are calling it the oil cartel, you know, comparing it to the drug market.
Well, but if you make that comparison to the drug market, you get back to the idea of the kingpins and the idea that there's demand. And we know that, and of course, this is the tragedy with Mexico. 50, 60,000 Mexicans are killed because the Americans have a drug habit. In this case, I'm curious to know about these people who know how to divert and siphon off the oil through the pipes into illegal tankers, either on the ground or in the ocean. So there must be a global market for illegal oil, because I understand, you know, under the sanctions that Iran's having now, they're offering black market oil as well. So I'd be curious to know how the black market, the global black market in oil works. Do you know anybody that has studied that?
Well, I don't have a study right now, but from what I know, I would say that, it started with precisely that people who were in higher places will divest some of the oil. And say, for example, I own I'm in charge of this oil well, and you are the partner. And then I will make you sign that you received 10 barrels, when in fact it was 15. And that 15 goes to me. You know, that's how it started. And it still is, to the extent that, in fact, during the military days, a lot of military generals, got rich overnight, billionaires overnight doing that. And so that culture has continued that, yeah, the kingpins, absolutely, that the kingpins who have the wherewithal, who know how to, siphon it, and who know how to transport it, and who know how to take it abroad. In fact, some of them even have, there have been reports of them having actually tankers themselves and siphoning it and taking it out to the global market and selling them illegally for cheap. And there have been also accusations that the oil companies have been in collaboration with these big people who, because they collaborate with them so they can allow them to continue to have access to the oil wells.
Sure, and they probably get by discounted stolen oil. It's probably cheaper.
Absolutely, that's right. The point.
Yes. That's the point, right? Well, look, I'm afraid we've run out of time. This is a fascinating discussion, Anita, and we should stay in touch. And I'd like to learn more about this.
All right, then. Thank you. You have a wonderful night.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Anita Okure, who is Executive Director of Africa Faith and Justice Network, a community of advocates for responsible U.S. relations with Africa. He was born in Nigeria and has served in various pastoral capacities in Nigeria, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and the United States. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Farhan Mohammed. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Quiet voice,